Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Hello, everyone. This is Administrative Static, and I'm John Vecchione. And our first topic for today is South Bay United Pentecostal Church versus Gavin Newsom, governor of California. And the question here is what the governor and the states can do by decree to religious organizations and religious worship. And this has come up a number of times during the pandemic, and we've spoken about it before. And the New Civil Liberties Alliance has some cases involving this across the country, at least what you can, what governors can do and what administrative agencies can do to curtail the pandemic under the Constitution. And this is a very interesting case. It's an injunction. So the church, South Bay United Pentecostal Church, moved for an injunction saying this decree by Governor Newsom is unconstitutional because it singles us out for different treatment from other groups. And what it did was it banned all indoor worship in the state of California. And it also banned singing and chanting and that sort of thing. And it had capacity limitations for, in general, for all businesses. And what the court did was say, whatever your capacity prohibitions are for other businesses similarly situated, you can do on churches, but you can't treat them differently. Because what the court is concerned about and what they keep talking about is that religion isn't a hobby. It is a protected activity, and worship is a protected activity, and it's a free exercise issue, and they are going to carefully scrutinize what the governors are doing. But one of the reasons I bring it up is because of the unusual breakdown of the various opinions, and I'm going to read what they actually held, which was respondents, meaning California and Governor Newsom, are enjoined, that means stopped, from enforcing the blueprint's Tier 1 prohibition on indoor worship services against applicants pending disposition of the petition for writ of certiorari. What that means is, while we're getting ready to look at this case in detail, you can't do these certain things. And then the court went on to say, though, that the injunction was denied with respect to the percentage capacity limitations. Respondents are not enjoined from imposing a 25% capacity limitation on indoor worship services. What they had done was say no indoor worship services, but they had a 25% capacity limit on other businesses. And the court said, hey, if you're doing this to everybody, that's one thing. If you're singling out the churches, that's another. And then the application.
Well, Vec, because this was a zero attendance policy at churches, you couldn't even go in as an individual to, if you're Catholic, to get confession or anything like that. They were completely closed.
That is correct. They've said that because, and Kagan will say this, I'll note it, is that because the weather in California is so mild, it doesn't really matter much. But, I mean, I know they have Sierra Mountains where it snows there. I know they have, I've been to San Francisco, and I don't think being outdoors in San Francisco in winter to worship is a good option, particularly in that cold rain. But
no, that was a facile observation.
Exactly. I feel like Sinatra. I don't like California. It's cold and it's damp. So
I didn't know we were getting a song and dance routine today, but anyway.
So it says this order is without prejudice to applicants presenting new evidence to the district court that the state is not applying the percentage capacity limitation or the prohibition on singing and chanting in generally applicable manner. So what they've said is you got to treat businesses, but that there's it's a very interesting split. Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch would have said, hey, this whole injunction is granted. What California is doing to churches is completely unconstitutional. And it appears from their opinion that they simply don't believe that strict scrutiny, which is the highest analysis that the court gives to an action by the government, wasn't met. Basically, California did not prove that everything it was doing was absolutely necessary to stop COVID, and it didn't match up, in their view, to what it allowed other organizations to do. For instance, one of the big issues here is, just like in a Nevada case where they kept the casinos open and closed the church, wouldn't you know it, Hollywood somehow gets to sing in its sound studios. So the question there is whether or not they're treating the church as different. And Justice Kagan says they're not, because the Hollywood studios have to test everybody every day. Every day they have to test everyone in the room, and you can't do that at churches. And she points out a lot of differences. So there's a big fight here. It's kind of interesting. And then Justice Alito, he wouldn't even agree with Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch. And he thought that he would let the he would stay. He wanted them to prevent more information on singing and chanting. And so he would have allowed it for 30 days, and he would have the state look at it, present more evidence to the district court. So he was basically on the fence. He said, you know, there could be a good reason here. This might not just be hostility towards religion, or more like indifference to religious practice.
I think that the prohibition, if I'm not mistaken, on singing in church, and this wasn't just churches, also synagogues and temples and
mosques
and what have you. And so even if you had a lone cantor at a service, that was also prohibited, even if that person was socially distanced from the rest of the congregation. And yeah. I think that bespeaks a certain antipathy, I think.
Even if you were behind plexiglass, you couldn't do it. So yeah. It looks suspect, but I think they wanted more information, because was the prohibition just overbroad, or did they mean to do that, I think was the question. The interesting one, however, is Justice Roberts. Justice Kagan quotes Justice Roberts from previous cases all through her attack on the court's various opinions, because she believes that the houses
of worship, that quoting Chief Justice Roberts will turn his opinion.
Exactly. Exactly. He did not like that. He did not like that. Because, you know, he had said that unelected judges shouldn't be doing certain things. So she said they shouldn't be doing this. And she said it's unclear whether the court disbelieves the science or doesn't think it's important. And she used the science. And science is a process of various information coming in and being assessed. So I'm not a great fan of the singular article with science, but there you have it.
Fixed for all time.
Exactly. So here she really used Robert's previous opinions about second guessing the elected officials on this. But I think that both sides kind of overlooked what they did say in the last one, was particularly Gorsuch, was that this pandemic has gone on for a while. And the emergency nature of it and the unknowns are less than they were. But they don't really say that this time. But here's what Robert says after he's quoted that elected officials are better at this, and we can't step in every time. At the same time, the state's present determination that the maximum number of adherents who can safely worship in the most cavernous cathedral is zero appears to reflect not expertise or discretion, but instead insufficient appreciation or consideration of the interests at stake. I adhere to the view that, quote, and then he quotes himself, the Constitution principally entrusts the safety and health of people to the politically accountable officials of the states. But the Constitution also entrusts the protection of the people's rights to the judiciary, not despite judges being shielded by life tenure. And then he cites Kagan J. dissenting. But because they are, deference, though broad, has its limits. And I think that we will be using deference, though broad, has its limits quite a bit in the future, Mark.
That's a pretty good quote. So this was Chief Justice Roberts, you said?
Yes.
So he's saying to Justice Kagan, anything you can quote from me, I can quote better. Is that
exactly? I knew what I meant. And here it is. And Justice Barrett and Justice Kavanaugh, they put in an opinion that seemed to be, hey, look, we're not getting in the middle of these people.
There would have been a popcorn emoji if emojis were allowed in opinions.
I think that's right. And so they did a very jurisprudential burden of proof. They thought the burden of proof to show that the entitlement to sing and chant was on the plaintiffs. It was on the church. It wasn't on the government. So they thought that they hadn't shown that Hollywood's singing and chanting was the same as their singing and chanting. And they thought they had to show that to show the disparate treatment of religion.
Let me ask about that real quick. So is that just because it was in a preliminary injunction?
Yeah. Yeah. They don't have
posture
information. I think this tracks Alito. They're just not sure. There wasn't enough stuff that they could look at it and make a decision. They felt that each side had decent arguments on that issue, but it hadn't been fleshed out enough below is kind of what I get out of the case.
Because ordinarily the burden would be on the state.
Correct. But I guess the state had made its pitch and they had to come back with something.
Okay.
Kagan makes a big deal that the churches didn't have epidemiological data, which I don't think churches have a lot of that stuff. She wouldn't look behind the curtain. Basically, she wouldn't look behind what the state says about this. So, anyways, interesting opinion. They're all after each other on this one. Once again, the church is committed. We'll be back at home.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. Mark Chenoweth here with John Vecchione. And Vec, for this second segment, I wanted to talk a little bit about qualified immunity, particularly the doctrine of qualified immunity in the context of Title IX. The New Civil Liberties Alliance this week filed a cert petition to the U.S. Supreme Court in a case called Walsh v. Hodge et al. And Dr. Walsh was a doctor at the University of North Texas Health Science Center, whose contract was terminated after he and a couple of other faculty members and a couple of medical students attended a medical conference. And when they got back, one of the students accused him of sexual harassment. And the university's response to this was to hire an outside investigator to investigate the student's complaint, who then conducted a series of interviews, but never held a formal hearing and never provided the professor an opportunity to cross-examine or confront the accuser in a hearing context, either directly or indirectly.
Mark, I think we should just note that Title IX is a statute that simply provides that women will not be denied equal opportunities in education. And that's the hook upon which all this rests.
That's right. And so it's perfectly appropriate under federal law as currently constituted that if a student were sexually harassed by a professor, that they would bring a Title IX proceeding or would file a Title IX charge against the professor, and the universities have these on-campus tribunals where they essentially try. It could be a student or in this case a professor, but the thing that was different here was, again, there was no hearing, there was no due process a given. So set aside the guilt or innocence question here, because that's not really part of the case as presented to the Supreme Court. The question is simply on this lack of due process, and then as I mentioned at the outset, on this question of qualified immunity. Well, what's qualified immunity? Qualified immunity is the idea that if you are a government official and you're acting under the color of law and you violate someone's rights, then you would have to pay damages for violating someone's rights. There's a federal statute that allows for filing lawsuits in this kind of circumstance. Or here it would be state officials. So you could file a Section 1983 lawsuit for deprivation of your civil rights. But there is a defense that can be raised by government actors, and the qualified immunity defense allows them to say that the law was not the law that they violated was not clearly established. That is the key phrase. And so the court could look at the circumstance and could decide that even though the law was violated and that civil liberties, in this case of Dr. Walsh, were violated, that the law was not clearly established enough that the people who violated his civil liberties, meaning the folks who were in charge of the Title IX tribunal operation on the campus, aren't going to be held to account for that. Now, in this case, Dr. Walsh went to federal district court in the Northern District of Texas, and he won, at least on this narrow point about qualified immunity. And the court found that that the law was clearly established and that the University of North Texas Health Science Center needed to have provided him, or more particularly, the individuals he was suing, who were other employees of the university, that they had violated his civil liberties and that the law was clear, that there needed to be some opportunity for cross-examination, particularly in this kind of a he said, she said situation, where credibility is really the keystone on whether or not sort of whose version of events one is going to believe, who the trier of fact is going to believe. Credibility is a very significant factor here. And so you have to have cross-examination to test the credibility of the witness. And the individuals appealed that qualified immunity ruling up to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. And the Fifth Circuit found that that there was qualified immunity for these individuals, and the reasons for that are interesting, Vex. So the one reason that they gave was that there was a split in the circuits on the question. So what that means is we have 13 federal circuit courts of appeals across the United States, and the Fifth Circuit, where this came up, covers the states of Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi, for example. And each of those circuits, not every circuit has always examined every question of law, because they come up at different times in different cases. And on this question of whether or not public universities have to provide these sort of confrontation clause, due process hearing rights to folks in the Title IX context, there are several circuit courts that have now said, yes, you do. And there are a few circuit courts, or at least a couple, that have said, no, you don't. And then there are several that have not reached the question at all. And within the Fifth Circuit, there had been some district court decisions saying that you had to have some level you had to have due process and some level of ability to confront or cross-examine. But the Fifth Circuit looked at the precedent within the circuit, and then looked at this split with other circuits and said that the mere presence of a circuit split across the circuits meant that the law was not clearly established, and therefore that qualified immunity would be extended to the university employees for failing to provide the sort of constitutional rights to Dr. Walsh. So Vec, a question for you. Does that make sense to you that just the mere presence of a split in the circuits would mean that the law is not clearly established?
No, I would think that if, particularly if you're a district court, what are you supposed to do? What if your district, what if your circuit it has a clear rule and the other circuits are split? Does that make it not part of the law for you? That would be crazy because you are bound to follow the law of your circuit. And the law of your circuit is clear no matter what you think of the appellate judges there and what they said. So I think it just causes confusion. It's one thing to say that that the circuit split, you know, you're bound by this circuit's rulings, whatever you think. But to make the district court have to make a judgment like that on a qualified immunity is pretty bad, particularly with you and I both know that qualified immunity, they get down into the weeds if this is the exact same factual pattern that happened in this other place with this factual pattern. I mean, it's such a needle to thread to throw this in there. Really hurts the plaintiff, and I don't really see a need for it. The only thing that strikes me is if your circuit says something, I think as a district court, you're bound by what they say, even if there's a split.
And I think if it's clear enough for the district court to be bound, then that should mean that it's clearly established enough the folks appearing in front of that court to be bound by it as well. So I think that would be a better rule, a better way to think about it. The other thing lurking in the background here is that the folks who designed this Title IX program and who made the decision not to accord these civil liberties that are protected by the Fifth Amendment and in principle, at least by the Sixth Amendment, although this isn't a criminal trial, the folks who set this up had all the time in the world, Vec, to set the program up and to come up with the rules. This is not the same situation as the police officer in hot pursuit of the suspect, or who is engaged in a search and has to decide, you know, whether to draw their weapon or whether they can follow someone in a certain place. You know, those sorts of split second decisions that police officers have to make, maybe not on a daily basis, but certainly frequently. That seems like a very different sort of context for qualified immunity than where you have university officials who have lots of time and, I should add, all the ability in the world to go to the general counsel's office at the university or other legal advisors and say, hey, what are the rules here? What do we have to legally provide? And I think what you don't want is a system in which the qualified immunity rules that apply to that split second decision, which might be a little more lax just because of the lack of opportunity to really fully think something through, that would apply to this situation of these sort of desk officials who have all the time in the world to think about the consequences of their action.
And not only do they have all the time in the world, they have, you know how many Title IX officers are at these schools now? You know how many Title IX people they have? They've got, you know, more than Dartmouth had when Webster made his famous speech about how much he loved the place. They have more Title IX officers than they had professors at the whole colleges in the old days. So I think they've got plenty of resources to get it right in a way that the cop in hot pursuit does not.
Exactly. And so that's what this cert petition is teeing up to the Supreme Court is two questions. One question along the lines of whether or not the circuit split is enough, and another question along the lines of whether this having more time to set up the program makes a difference, and whether the exact same rules should apply in that situation as apply to the officer in hot pursuit or making split second decisions. And I think that it'll be interesting to see if the court takes this up. They had an opportunity to take up quite a few qualified immunity cases last May and June, and they turned them all down. So I don't know that there's the appetite right now for qualified immunity cases, but I think if there is, this is a pretty clean shot, Vec. I think there's the issues here are pretty well specified, and there isn't a lot of extra issues lurking in these cases. So if there's a qualified immunity case that the court is willing to take, this might be it.
Excellent.